One more time. It is finished. All right. You can open your eyes. Did that feel good? Did it? No? Okay. Note, don't ask congregation questions anymore. I know it's like difficult business to pick favorite Bible verses, right? Or favorite sayings. We probably shouldn't be doing that, but this is one of my favorites. As you all know, we've been doing a Lenten series on the seven last words, the seven final sayings of Jesus. And today our saying is, of course, it is finished. Now, in Greek, this is actually just a single word, tetelestai. Say that with me, tetelestai. Is that fun to say? No, I just said don't ask the church questions. It should be fun to say. I like it, tetelestai. It feels kind of beautiful and rhythmic and artistic and weighty, doesn't it? Tetelestai. So, because I love this word so much, who's ready for a super nerdy language lesson? Yeah. Awesome. There I go, asking questions again. I shouldn't have done that, but here we go. So, I think this word, tetelestai, is in that sort of rare category of words like shalom or shema or agape, a word that sort of tells a story in and of itself. It's like a single word that somehow manages to communicate the whole gospel just in one thing, kind of captures the imagination. So we're just gonna nerd out for a couple minutes, and I'm gonna teach you a bunch of stuff you didn't wanna know about a single word. So to parse this word out, we can break it up essentially into three parts. Te, telos, and tai. So let's divide it up into three parts and let's work backwards. So the third part of the word, tai, is the conjugation. Now, you're probably all having some traumatic flashbacks to high school Spanish or perhaps even French. I don't know. French is a weird language because they teach you all the conjugations and then they go, but by the way, no one pronounces them anyway, so who cares? But anyways, conjugations at the end of a word, if you remember from high school language class, tell you whether a word is first person, second person, or third person, or singular, or plural. So I, we, he, she, it, they, etc. Well, in this case, it is third person singular, as you could tell from the translation, it. In Greek, the ending of a word can also tell you whether a verb is active or passive. So for example, I punched is an active verb. I was punched is a passive verb. So here, tetelestai is a passive verb, meaning that Jesus isn't saying, I am finishing, though he is. He's saying, it is finished, or it is being finished. The focus, the point is on the thing being finished, not on him. Now, let's move backwards again to the middle of the word. This is the heart of the word, both sort of literally and figuratively. It is the main verb. So telos is the middle part of the verb, which is just a version of the verb teleo, which you'll see come up on the screen. It means to complete or fulfill or accomplish or bring to perfection or even to finish a race. So in 2 Timothy 4:7, when Paul says, I have fought the good fight and I have finished the race, the verb he's using there is teleo. He's saying he teleoed the race. In Hebrews 12:2, when the author calls Jesus the author and perfecter of our faith, the perfecter is the teleo of our faith. Again, the same word. So, finish the race, perfect something, complete something. Teleo is not just about something coming to an end. It's about completing, perfecting, making something whole and finished in that way. In that way, in fact, it probably has some connection to the Hebrew word that we talk about fairly frequently, shalom, which we translate as peace, but really more accurately means wholeness or completeness. It means peace as in everything put together the way that it's supposed to be, that kind of comprehensive peace. Many scholars believe that that's maybe what Jesus actually said on the cross, because obviously here, tetelestai is a translation. Jesus wasn't a Greek speaker. He was a Hebrew/Aramaic speaker. But what he probably said in some way on the cross was some version of the word shalom. I'm making peace. I'm bringing it to completeness, to wholeness. Now, there are a couple important points that I want to make about this word, teleo. First, teleo, if you were to read the Gospel of John in Greek, is one of the most important words in the Gospel. It pops up over and over and over again. And sometimes we miss this because it gets translated as different things, or we just have a hard time keeping up with themes like that. But John 4:34, Jesus said this, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work," teleo. Or John 5:36, "I have testimony weightier than that of John, for the works that the Father has given me to finish," teleo, "the very works that I am doing testify that the Father has sent me." Or John 17:4, as Jesus prays in the Garden of Gethsemane, "I have brought you glory on earth by finishing," teleo, "the work you gave me to do." So one of the central themes in the Gospel of John is that Jesus has been sent to finish something, to complete some work. The whole gospel has been anticipating and pointing forward to this moment where Jesus says, tetelestai. It has been teleoed. Second, even outside of the New Testament, teleo is an extremely and uniquely important word. Teleo, and specifically its noun form, telos. So if you've been reading our book, You Are What You Love, you've heard this word, telos, a bunch of times. So telos was central to Greek philosophy, specifically the thought of Aristotle. Telos meant something's purpose or appropriate end or use. So Aristotle said that you could only understand something by understanding its telos, its use, its purpose. So for example, a hammer. You could describe a hammer in a lot of different ways. You could describe it by its properties, right? It has a long wooden handle. It has a heavy metal end or a flat side on one side. But describing its qualities alone would not make you truly understand what a hammer was. To understand it, you have to understand its telos, its purpose, its end use. It's meant to hammer nails. What was it made to do? That's what defines it. Now, I don't want to get too lost in the weeds here, though we may already have, but given all this, I want to point out how incredibly brilliant the Gospel of John is. It begins with, "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God, and the Logos became flesh." Now, the "in the beginning" part is clearly a reference to Genesis 1, but as we've talked about a number of times before, Logos is also an incredibly important word/concept in Greek thought and philosophy. English translations usually translate it as word, which isn't wrong, but it is woefully incomplete. Logos is the word we get logic from. In Greek philosophy, the Logos was the eternal logic and wisdom behind the universe. It's unifying principle, it's rationality, it's reason. So, if you could pan out and look at the whole Gospel of John, and you had an eye for the original languages and the thought of the day, you would see how it ties together in these incredible ways. John begins with the logos, the beginning, the reason, and then the whole gospel from there is pointing towards a telos, a completion, an appropriate end, which of course is the cross and this word, tetelestai. Jesus is the logos, and his telos is the cross. I think that's beautiful and amazing. Now, everyone in here is either completely exhilarated or utterly confused, and we've only done 2/3 of the word. So, let's finish up our word study and go all the way to the beginning. So there is a prefix on the front of the word, te, before the telos. And that te is actually really, really important. This tells us that the form of the verb is a present perfect verb. And if you just fell asleep, wake back up. This is actually slightly important, okay? This is cool. At least I think it's cool. When a verb is a perfect verb, it adds a syllable sort of at the beginning, doubling the first consonant and vowel. So that's why it's te telestai. And it kind of makes the word feel like it has like a lead up to it, like a preceding element, which actually kind of illustrates what it means. So in the present tense, there are actually three different tenses or three aspects to the present tense. There's the simple present, the present imperfect, and the present perfect, okay? The simple present just indicates simple or general action. So for example, I cook. We're going to use cook. I must have been hungry when I was writing this. I cook. That's the simple present. The present imperfect indicates an action that you're doing right now, but it's still ongoing. So I am cooking. I am cooking dinner. Implication, I'm in the process of cooking, but it's not done yet, so get out of the kitchen and leave me alone. And then finally, you have the present perfect. And present perfect is the tense that indicates that an action was ongoing, but is now completed and has lasting effects for the future. To continue with the cooking example, I have cooked dinner is the present perfect, right? Implication, I was cooking probably for a long time, you ungrateful teenagers. But nevertheless, I was cooking, but now it is completed, and dinner is ready, and now we can eat. So none of the other uses of teleo in the Gospel of John are in this particular construction, are perfect, which means this is intentional. It is purposeful. Now here's why this matters. First, it means that the work that Jesus is finishing here on the cross is part of a process. It's part of a long process. It's a work that God has been doing for a very long time. It's not a light switch. It's a culmination, a conclusion. And this, I think, is important for us to be reminded of from time to time, because sometimes in the modern church, we have a tendency to act like the cross is a unique one-off event. And in a way, it is. I mean, it's a unique occurrence in all of human history. It can't be repeated. But what it really is the telos of a long journey. It's the finishing of a race. A long story from sin all the way to salvation. From creation all the way to Calvary. Second, it means that the completion of this work that Jesus is effecting creates a new reality. It's an end and a new beginning. To use the cooking analogy again, the long process of cooking is completed, not so you can stare at the food, but so that the meal may begin. The end of one story is the beginning of another. That's what the perfect verb does. And that second story is only made possible by the first. In other words, and I recognize this is about to be the nerdiest thing I've said in 15 years at this church, okay? You ready? Even the grammar of this line is theological. The way the word is constructed is itself a theology of the cross. The perfect form of the verb tells a story of an ongoing work, which is now completed, leaving lasting ongoing effects, a changed world, a new situation, a new reality in its wake. And that is exactly what Jesus is doing on the cross. He is God's perfect verb, completing the work so that a new thing can begin. All right, let's change gears for a minute. Last week, my family and I went up to New York City for a few days on spring break. The kids had never been before, and Holly and I had been before, but it had been like 20 plus years ago. And it was a really great trip, other than the fact that the whole city smells like weed now. I think they've legalized marijuana in the state of New York. I'm just guessing, based on my olfactory senses. And literally the whole city smells like weed. There's, I don't know how many, like 8 million people in New York, and 1 million are smoking weed at all times. And it's a sad day when you're like, you long for the urine smell of the subway to get the smell of weed out of your nose. But anyways, olfactory issues aside, it was an amazing trip. And we packed in as much as we could in the time that we were there. So on Wednesday, the first night that we were there, we went to a Yankees game. There you go. There are a couple of pictures of that. Sorry. I know we have some Mets fans in the house. But if this makes you feel better, it was like 40 degrees and raining the whole time that day. So the next day was like 72 the whole day. So I wish we'd have bought tickets for the next day, but we bought them like 6 weeks in advance. But it was like 40 degrees and raining, and the Yankees played like hot garbage. They got shut out 4-0. I think they had two hits the whole game. Aaron Judge, who's one of the best hitters in the game, was 0-for-3 with three strikeouts when we left in the seventh inning. But that aside, it was still a really cool experience to be able to go there. Then Friday night, the last night that we were there, we went to see Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on Broadway, and that was really, really cool. They have figured out some crazy special effects for a live show. I have no idea how they've done it, and I won't spoil any of it for you in the hopes that you will get to go someday, but I will say this, there are flying Dementors that actually come out into the audience. It's awesome. Okay. And in between those two sort of book-ended events, we just pounded the pavement, like all over the city. You'll see some pictures coming up as we talk about it. But we hit up three different New York-style pizza joints, because you got to compare them, right? My favorite was Bleecker Street Pizza, just in case you're taking notes. We went to two incredible bagel places, which was just a ton of fun. We went to Hudson Yards, and we did the High Line, which is like an old overground railroad track that they've turned into a walkway and a park. We rode the Staten Island Ferry to see the Statue of Liberty. We rode the Roosevelt Island Tramway, both of which are free if you have a MetroCard, and free is my favorite four-letter word. We saw Times Square, Greenwich Village, the Flatiron Building, the Chelsea Market, the Little Island, South Street Seaport, Central Park, Wall Street, Trinity Church, where Alexander and Eliza Hamilton are buried, and we saw the beautiful St. Patrick's Cathedral. It was a wonderful, wonderful trip. But I think in some ways, the highlight of the whole trip for us was the 9/11 memorial. Holly and I were in college when 9/11 happened. And we went to New York City in our early 20s, not long after it. And at that point, the memorial was mostly just a huge hole in the ground with some informational signs, which was moving and powerful in and of itself. But it was amazing to see now how they've transformed it and what they've done with it. The primary part of the memorial is essentially two enormous waterfall pools built into the footprint of the old buildings. And around the edges of the memorial, the name of every person who lost their lives in the towers that day is etched on the metal parapets. And there are 400 trees, identical trees planted around the grounds, memorializing people who didn't die in the towers but died later from sickness or after effects from the attacks. The new One World Trade Center tower, we learned from a retired American history teacher that now volunteers at the site, it's the exact height, the building structure is the exact height of the previous twin towers, and the tower on top of it stretches to a symbolic and intentional 1,776 feet, which is pretty cool. Every element of the site is perfectly planned and intentional, but there's one piece that uniquely captivated us, and that is the survivor tree. So this is the picture that we took of the survivor tree. The next one is a professional picture that's a little bit better. But when 9/11 happened, obviously it was both an emotional and logistical nightmare. It took months, years even, to clean up. Well, nearly a month into the cleanup process, they found and removed a tree, a charred and broken tree under layers and layers of rubble. And they were going to just dispose of it, but someone there saw it and noticed that at least part of the tree somehow appeared to still be alive. So they dug it out from the rubble and decided to try to preserve it. The Department of Parks and Recreation took the tree and moved it to another site and replanted it and tried to nurse it back to health. And it survived and began to thrive again. And in 2010, 9 years after the attack, and within a year of the official opening of the new memorial in the park, the tree was returned to its home in the center of the memorial square, a symbol of the old and the new, death and new life. And even more interesting, I found, is that from 2013 to 2023, New York City would take saplings from the survivor tree and give them to other towns and cities where tragedies had taken place. So, Newtown, Las Vegas, when the shooting took place there, Boston, when the Boston Marathon bombing took place. And it would give them as signs of solidarity and hope. So there are at least 30 pieces of the survivor tree out there in other places, planted in other towns and cities, growing, expanding new life. Also, something I find really interesting, the tree itself just happens to be a calorie pear tree, which, like the Bradford pear trees here in Raleigh, bloom early in spring, before anything else comes back to life. So as you can see in that picture, after the dead of winter, while all the surrounding trees are still somewhat barren, the survivor tree bursts into life. A first fruits, so to speak, of that life that is coming in spring, both beautiful and fitting, I thought. And as we experience this, and as I've reflected on it since, I can't help, obviously, but think of all the resonances it has with this season that we're in as we enter Holy Week, and with our line today, it is finished. It is completed. The story of the 9/11 memorial is you have this tragedy, this act of death and destruction, and it brings death and pain and remorse. And then, in the rubble of that tragedy, a long, ongoing work of redemption and repair begins. First, cleaning away the debris and surveying the damage. Then creating a plan Not just to commemorate the tragedy, but to build a sign of hope out of it. And then you set to work relaying foundations and building new walls and buildings and fountains and inscribing names and laying stones and planting trees. And then, after this long and arduous work, a tree is brought and put in the middle of it. A tree that is continuous with the past, but is saying something new as well. And it's planted. And then, and only then, is it complete. Is it finished? Now, perhaps I'm finding patterns and resonances that aren't there or weren't initially intended. And you know what? That's fine. That's what we humans do. As C.S. Lewis once said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So if I see the Christian pattern where it wasn't intended, well, there are worse things to see. But as I see it, this is the story of humanity, is it not? I mean, there was a tragedy. A breach, sin with a capital S, entered the world, and the world broke, and we were all left in the rubble. And then an arduous, centuries-long work began, a work to heal and repair and redeem. And as the work was being done, it seemed to become more clear and more intimate and more personal along the way. It took on greater and greater definition. And then, when all the other pieces had been put in place, a tree was brought and placed in the middle of it all. And the work was finally finished, brought to its beautiful completion. And as with the survivor tree, the completion was not an end per se, but a new beginning. New people would be welcomed into this garden, and saplings would be taken from this tree and sent out to bring this hope and healing to all sorts of new places. It would not remain confined to the spot where the tragedy initially took place. It would spread its branches, literally and figuratively, all over the world, bringing new life everywhere. It is finished is such a beautiful line, I think, when considered in the context of this cosmic story. Humanity's long, winding, painful struggle coming to an end. God's work of forgiveness, redemption, and restoration reaching completion. But I also find it deeply beautiful on a personal level. And I think the word that best describes why is the word catharsis. I find this line, it is finished, to be cathartic, which is why we did the weird little thing at the beginning. The dictionary definition of catharsis is the process of releasing and thereby providing relief from strong or repressed emotions. It's a release, an exhale. When I hear it is finished, I'm kind of stopped in my tracks. And I feel a compulsion to just let go, to exhale, to release all that I've been holding onto, white-knuckling so tightly, and just rest. Because it is finished reminds me that the work is done. The work of salvation has been completed. And not by me. I, like all of you, I presume, have been raised in a very secular, individualistic environment, which has taught me from the day that I was born that I am what I make of myself. I am what I produce, what I create, what I acquire. So get to work and don't stop. And in this world, there is like no rest for souls. Because we're always haunted by the idea that we're not doing enough. We haven't proved enough. I've told this story before, but when I was in high school, my dad, who was a college football coach, was privileged enough to win a national championship with the team that he was coaching. The highest goal that exists in that world, in that profession. And I went into the weight room a few weeks later, and the players were all working out, and they had new shirts on that said down or sideways. And I've always thought to myself that that was such a good microcosm of life in our world and in our culture. In our world, the work is never finished. We spend our lives thinking, if I could just get there, I will be complete. If I can just do that, it will be finished. And then we get there, and it's not. And we're not. There's always more work to do. Every achievement begets another goal. Every win brings fear of the next potential loss. You would think that achievement begets security, but it doesn't. It breeds more insecurity. There is no destination. We always have to work and strive and struggle. And we're told that it all depends on us. It's all about control and mastery and dominion. And then, in this one word, tetelestai, we are reminded that all of that nonsense is an illusion, a self-defeating idol, a hamster wheel prison we have created for ourselves. It has been completed. It has been finished. It is already done. In many ways, our faith is antithetical to the modern world that you and I have been raised in, because it's not all about us. It's actually not about us at all. It's not about what we do. It's about what's been done for us. The word we translate as grace, charis, is also the word that charity comes from. You and I, folks, are charity cases. And when I get over myself, I see how wonderful that is. My sins are forgiven. I am loved. I am embraced, not because of anything I've done or can do, but because of what Jesus did. My only job is to respond to that the best way I can, to live my life infected by the wonder of that story. And in that, I can finally rest and find some peace. The struggle can be released because it is already finished. Perhaps this week, as you go through Holy Week and you feel the oppressive burdens of our world weighing down on you, maybe "it is finished" can be a little running prayer or mantra for you, or even tetelestai if you're feeling kind of Greek. Am I good enough? It is finished. Am I accomplishing enough? It is finished. Am I the perfect parent? It's finished. It's finished. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that it is finished. We live with these burdens, these fears, these anxieties, that we're not enough, but it is finished. We are a part of the most beautiful story that's ever been told. Help us just remember that. Help us remember that it is finished. It is completed. The race has been run. And we thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.